Right, spry. That's what I am. And if you decide to suddenly lunge at me, I'll put a fucking bullet right through your face. He smiled. Okay, I said. Just warning you in advance. I don't want you to get any silly ideas. I held up both my hands. I'll stay right here, I said. Good. I trust you. Now we can talk. I keep thinking about the thing you just wrote me about fiction and reality, how your list of murders was fiction and that there's some difference. I think you're right about that, Mal, but I think you're seeing it the wrong way. Fiction is so much better than reality. I know, I've been alive a long time. And you know where I learned that from, about fiction? I learned it from you. You got me into reading, and you got me into murder. It changed my life for the better. Hey, do you think they have beer here? I wouldn't mind a cold beer while we talk.
I'm sure they do, I said. He looked from the table all the way into the kitchen, where the large refrigerator gleamed in the dim lighting.
Can you go get us a couple? Can I trust you not to try and do something stupid?
Sure, I said.
I got up and walked to the kitchen while Marty pointed the gun in my direction.
I passed the two couches. Humphrey the dog was now sprawled on the couch opposite from Tess, both of them asleep and oblivious. I opened the refrigerator, hunted around, and spotted two bottles of Heineken buried toward the back, located a bottle opener in one of the drawers, and popped their tops.
Oh, Heineken, Marty said, smiling when I put it in front of him. That's a pleasant surprise.
He took a sip, and so did I. My mouth was dry and gluey, and the beer tasted good, despite the circumstances.
Yeah, twice you've changed me, Mal. You know that? Marty said, as though the conversation we'd started had kept running through his brain while I'd gotten the beers. You introduced me to killing, and you introduced me to reading, and my life got better.
I doubt I introduced you to killing, I said. He laughed.
Oh, you did. I was a cop. That didn't make me a killer.
In all, I think we talked 3 hours that night. Marty talked the most, his voice getting hoarser the longer he spoke. But despite this, the years seemed to fall away from him as he told his story. It was clear that doing what he'd done had brought new life to him. But it had not been enough. He also needed to tell someone about it. He told me how 5 years earlier, back in 2010, the year that Claire died, he'd still been an officer in the Smithfield Police Department, considering retirement and living with an unfaithful wife. On at least two separate occasions, he'd put a loaded gun into his mouth late at night. He'd even considered taking out his wife first, just to ensure she wouldn't enjoy herself anymore after he was gone. The only thing that really stopped him was his two kids, and the fact that they'd have to live with that for the rest of their lives. Still, he thought about it almost every day. Around this same time, he'd been part of a small task force that had taken down an amateur prostitution ring operating out of a Smithfield laundromat. They'd advertised their services on Craigslist, but also on a shadier website called Duckburg. Marty had started perusing both sites late at night, wondering if maybe he should have his own affair, wondering if he could arrange something like that online and if it would make a difference. It was where he found me, on Duckburg, looking for a fellow fan of Strangers on a Train. He hadn't read the book. Marty wasn't a reader yet, but he'd seen the movie as a kid and never forgotten it. Robert Walker, Farley Granger, I do your murder and you do mine. He'd responded to my query. He even considered asking me to kill his wife, but realized that he'd never get away with it, not even if he had an alibi. But there was someone he wanted dead even more than his cheating spouse. Norman Cheney had been a small-time business owner in Holyoke. He owned three service stations, none of them known for the excellence of their automotive service, but all of them known as being connected to the local drug trade. They'd never pinned anything concrete onto Cheney, but it was clear that he was money laundering at the very least, and possibly even dealing out of his stations. But what had gotten Marty's attention had been when Margaret Cheney, Norman's semi-estranged wife, had died in a house fire. All the local cops knew that Cheney had done it for the insurance money, property for the house and life for the wife, and that he'd subsequently fled to New Hampshire. He'd gotten away with it. After receiving Eric Atwell's name and address from me via message, he gave me Norman Cheney's name and address in return. Before shooting Eric Atwell in Southwell, Marty had done some research just to make sure that he wasn't killing some kind of saint. He'd discovered, of course, that Atwell was a known scumbag. There'd been a few arrests for minor violations, driving while intoxicated, possession of a controlled substance. But there'd also been 3 separate restraining orders filed against Atwell from 3 separate women, all alleging abuse. Killing Atwell had not been hard. Marty staked him out for a couple of days, learning that in the late afternoon, Atwell would often leave his house and go for long, strenuous walks, wearing headphones, utilizing the multiple isolated walking paths near his farmhouse. Using a gun that Marty had taken during an abandoned house search 2 years earlier, he followed him into a wooded section of Southwell and shot him 5 times. "You know that scene in The Wizard of Oz?" Marty said. "When it goes from black and white to color?" "Sure," I said. "That's what it was like for me. The world changed. And I guess I just assumed the world had changed for you as well. After I heard what happened to Norman Cheney." "It didn't," I said. "Well, it did, but it was the reverse. The world drained of color." He frowned and shrugged. "I guess I was wrong. Still, I figured that maybe you'd felt the same as me, and that I should find out who you were, maybe even meet you." As it was, I had been easy to find. Having done his prior research on Atwell, Marty had learned about Atwell's involvement in the death of Claire Mallory, married to a bookstore manager in Boston. Once Marty had my name, he found my blog, and in particular he found the list I'd written, 8 Perfect Murders. And there was Strangers on a Train, sitting right there in the middle of the list. Marty read the book, then read the remaining recommendations, and the world opened up some more for him. Before all this had happened, he'd been in a broken, loveless marriage. His son was struggling with drug addiction, and his daughter would still spend time with him, but he knew, down deep, that it was a chore for her. But now he discovered murder, and then, even better, he discovered reading. Marty signed the divorce papers, took early retirement, and moved to Boston. To be near me. In 2012, he started to come to readings, and eventually we got to know each other. I think he thought it was going to be enough to meet me, to become friends. Maybe we'd even eventually speak about what had happened, about the murders we'd committed for each other. But that didn't happen. Yes, we became friends, but it wasn't enough for him. And as I've already said, we started to spend less time together. And that was when he came up with the idea of finishing off the murders from the list I'd written. It was a way to bond with me, because bonding over a couple of beers was not getting it done. In other words, if I'd been better company, a whole bunch of people would never have been murdered. Or maybe that's simply not true. When Marty first killed Eric Atwell, it was like popping a bottle of champagne. The cork was never going to go back into the bottle. And now he had a whole bunch of murder methods to utilize for his new hobby. He just needed a victim. Before his wife had had an affair, back when Marty Kingship was still living out west in Smithfield, she'd read newscaster Robin Callahan's infamous book about the benefits of adultery. It was called Life's Too Long and had been published a year after she'd been caught in a love affair with her married co-anchor. It had been tabloid fodder for months, helped along by the fact that Callahan was a striking blonde and seemingly unrepentant. she cashed in on her notoriety by publishing a book that essentially argued that adultery was more natural than monogamy, that lifespans had increased too much to have it make sense for people to stay married forever. She made the talk show rounds, and the book rocketed up the bestseller charts. Marty Kingship blamed that book for his wife's subsequent fling with the family dentist. I'm sure he wasn't the only man or woman with bad feelings about Robin Callahan. But Marty was someone who'd murdered before, gotten away with it, and was itching to try again. He went through my list of perfect murders, seeing if there were any good ideas for how he could get away with the murder of Robin Callahan. He had particularly loved Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders, in which a specific killing was hidden among a string of murders made to look like they'd been done by a madman. What if he could do the same with Robin Callahan? Maybe kill a few people who all had similar names? Names of birds, for example? Then he thought he could even leave a single feather at the scene of each crime. Or better yet, mail a single feather to the local police. And that was what he did. He killed Robin Callahan inside her own home, having gotten inside by showing her his old police identification card. He also killed Ethan Byrd, a local student whom Marty found by searching through police reports looking for Byrd-related names. Ethan had been arrested at a sports bar in Lowell for threatening the bartender and for disturbing the peace. He found Jay Bradshaw the same way. He'd been arrested for rape, but never convicted. It turned out Bradshaw spent most of his days on the Cape sitting in his garage trying to sell used tools. Marty had pulled up in broad daylight, then beat Bradshaw to death with a baseball bat he'd brought and a sledgehammer he'd borrowed. As soon as he'd begun to plot the ABC murders, Marty knew that he couldn't stop until he'd finished the list. Bill Manso was another name he pulled from browsing police records, a man who had been investigated in a domestic disturbance, but someone who had also been accused by a neighbor of breaking into her house during the daytime, stealing her underwear. This had all happened 5 years previous, but Marty read up on the case, discovering that Manso had gotten off because he was a regular train commuter into New York City and that he'd provided evidence that he was commuting at the time of the break-in. The train made him think of Double Indemnity, another book on the list. Marty had read it, of course, but he'd also gotten the movie from the local library. He liked the movie better. It gave me a brand new appreciation of Fred McMurray. He decided to kill Bill Manso, bludgeon him to death and leave him on the tracks. Then he'd take the commuter rail himself the following morning, bust out a window at just the right time to make it look as though Manso had decided to jump. He knew it wouldn't wash. Scene of the crime investigators would know almost instantly that Manso had been killed elsewhere and that his body had been staged. But what excited Marty was that someone might start to figure it out, make a connection between the two books, and that it would lead back to me. Maybe they'd even arrest me. Either way, I'd become involved, and that was what he was hoping for. Marty wasn't sure how to gain access to Bill Manso, but when he got down to Connecticut, it was made easier by the fact that Manso liked to drink at the bar nearest to the train station. Manso would go directly from his commute to the Corridor Bar and Grill at 5:30 every day and stumble out of there at about 10 at night to drive the mile and a half to his townhouse condo. Marty killed him in the parking lot with a telescoping baton. Much better than a baseball bat, let me tell you. And left his body along the tracks. The next day, he took the train and punched out a window in between cars using the same steel baton. 4 murders in, Marty got impatient. He didn't say that in so many words, but he decided it was time to get a little more obvious. Time to get me involved. Like all the regulars at Old Devils, especially anyone who came to our author readings, Marty had known Elaine Johnson. She'd cornered him on numerous occasions to let him know the books he should be reading and the books that were a waste of time. She told him about that nasty lesbian who owned the apartment she lived in, and about how disgustingly dirty the city of Boston was, and about how, without her, the old devil's bookstore would have gone out of business years ago. And she told him about her heart condition, how her doctors had told her she should move to a quieter region, make sure that nothing stressed her out. Knowing she'd moved into her dead sister's house in Rockland, Maine, Marty paid her a visit. He broke into her house when she'd been out, probably terrorizing a staff member at some local bookstore, and hid in her bedroom closet. He wore a clown mask with a large, hideous mouth full of sharp teeth, and when Elaine Johnson came home, he waited patiently. He could hear her puttering around downstairs, oblivious to his presence. Eventually, she came upstairs to the bedroom and went straight to the closet, opening it up. All he had to do was stand there, then take a step toward her. She turned white, then pawed at her chest, then did exactly what he'd been hoping she'd do. She died of a heart attack. "Why'd you leave the books?" I said. "I wanted them to come to you, at some point, at least. I knew that the murder of Elaine Johnson was absolutely foolproof. There'd be no way any coroner would consider it a suspicious death. So I left the books, just hoping to muddy the waters. Hoping someone in law enforcement somewhere would be smart enough to put it all together."
"Someone did," I said.
"And you panicked and came running to me for help. I never thought that would happen, but I was thrilled when it did. It was good to hear your voice, asking me for a favor."
"You could have ended it there. You'd gotten what you wanted."
"No, what I wanted was to complete the project, but I wanted you along for the ride. And that's what we have now, the two of us. Do you want to hear the rest?"
Chapter 29.
After you told me that the FBI had paid you a visit, I knew that someone had finally noticed. I knew that the closer things got to you, the faster you'd try and figure out who I was. So, just to delay the inevitable, I handed you Nick Pruitt.
Marty told me that it was true that Pruitt had made a formal complaint against Norman Chaney after the house fire that killed Chaney's wife, Pruitt's sister. And for that reason, Marty had already checked Pruitt out before I ever asked him for information on Chaney's death. Pruitt was a recovering alcoholic with a few arrests on his record, someone Marty thought was the perfect candidate for the murder based on malice aforethought. If Pruitt suddenly died of alcohol poisoning, who would suspect it was a murder? He had a verifiable past as someone who abused alcohol. After Marty and I had drinks at Jack Crow's Tavern on that Wednesday night, Marty went to a liquor store and bought a bottle of scotch to take to Pruitt in New Essex.
"He just let me in. I'd shown him my gun, of course. Told him I needed him to take a few drinks. Once he started, he actually couldn't stop. It wasn't that hard to convince him to drink almost the whole bottle. I'd laced it with liquid benzos, just to be sure."
He smiled.
"After Pruitt was a dead end, I figured I could push you toward thinking Brian Murray or even Tess was involved. Did it work? Did you actually notice the brand of scotch?"
"I did," I said.
"That pleases me,"
Marty said, as though I'd just complimented him on his sweater.
"How well do you know Brian and Tess Murray?" I said. "Tess, I just met tonight. Played a little hide-and-seek with her around the house before you got here. I know Brian pretty well, just through the store, but over the past few years I've gotten into the habit of stopping by that hotel bar he likes and having a few with him. I actually saw you with the two of them on Tuesday night. I knew Tess was back because of Brian's broken arm. And now it's all set up. Police will find Brian's dead body in his home. I'm thinking a pillow over the face with a gun fired into it, and Tess will have disappeared. We can even pack a suitcase for her. It will be just like Red House Mystery. One dead body, one fleeing murderer. All we need is a good place to hide her body." What's wrong with her? With Tess, I said, glancing toward where she was still sleeping, curled up on the sofa. She hadn't moved.
I slipped some of that benzodiazepine into the coffee she was drinking. Put it in her port as well, and I think she had some of that. There's a good chance she took enough to put her over, but if not, I don't think it'll be a problem finishing her off. Something gentle, like a plastic bag over the head, should do it.
I think we'd both gotten used to hearing the steady snoring coming from Brian in the downstairs bedroom, but suddenly we both heard a loud, grunting snore, so violent that we both looked at each other. Marty picked the gun up off his thigh and turned his attention in that direction.
Sleep apnea, he said. I doubt he'll wake himself up, but let's go have a look.
He stood up, and I could hear his knees pop.
You too,
he said, pointing the gun toward me. I stood as well. Together we walked to the guest bedroom at the end of the hall, me first with Marty behind me. The door had been left open a crack, and I pushed through. It was dark inside, but a small amount of light came through a window so that I could see Brian lying on his back above the sheets of the bed. Tess had left his clothes on, but his pants were unbuttoned, his belt hanging loose. I watched as his chest fluttered a little, rising and falling fast. Then he let out another explosive snore. I didn't know how it hadn't woken him.
Jesus, Marty said from behind me. Let's put the motherfucker out of his misery.
I turned just as Marty flicked the wall switch, and the bedroom was suddenly flooded with light from a floor lamp. Above the bed that Brian was sleeping on was a large abstract painting, chunky blocks of red and black.
You can quit right now, Marty, I said. And do what?
Turn yourself in. We'll both do it. We'll go together. I knew it was a long shot, but Marty seemed tired, and it occurred to me that he was at the end of this particular game. Maybe, down deep, he wanted to get caught. He shook his head.
It sounds exhausting having to talk to all those cops, and then the lawyers and the psychiatrists. It's easier to keep going. We're almost done here. 8 perfect murders. Your favorite murders, Mal.
They were my favorites in books, not in real life. Marty was quiet for a moment, and I thought that he was maybe breathing a little heavy. For a moment, I fantasized that he might just keel over dead from a sudden heart attack. He looked up, though, and said,
I'll admit that the thought of it all being over is not unpleasant. I tell you what I will do for you. I'll let you have this one, have Brian, because frankly I've been doing all the heavy lifting since you took care of Norman Chaney. I'll give you this gun, and all you have to do is go put a pillow over his face and fire the gun into it. I don't think the neighbors will hear it, and if they do, they'll just figure they heard something else, a car backfiring or something.
Sure, I said, and held out my hand.
I know what you're thinking, Mal. If I give you the gun, then you can keep me at gunpoint and call the cops, but I'm not going to let that happen. I'll come after you, and you'll have to shoot me. So either way, you're going to have to shoot someone. It's either Brian here or me. I'm giving you that choice. And if it's me, that's okay. I've got a prostate the size of a wiffle ball. I've had my go around. I think these last few years getting to know you and playing this little game, it's all been gravy.
Not for everyone.
Huh. I suppose so. But down deep, like me, you know none of this really matters much. If I hand you this gun and you put a bullet through Brian's brain, you'll be doing him a favor, most likely. He just might like it, too. Trust me.
Okay, I said, extending my hand farther toward him. He smiled. Whatever I'd seen in his eyes earlier, that happiness, was gone now. I saw what I always used to see in his eyes. I always thought it was kindness. He put the gun in my hand. It was a revolver, and I pulled the hammer back.
It's a double-action revolver, Marty said. You don't actually need to cock the hammer.
I looked at Brian Murray, prostrate on the bed, and then I turned back to Marty and shot him in the chest. Chapter 30. The penultimate chapter of the murder of Roger Ackroyd is called The Whole Truth. It's when the narrator, the country doctor who is secretly the murderer, reveals to the readers exactly what he's done. I haven't given any of my chapters in this narrative a title. It's an old-fashioned convention, I guess, and it seems a little corny. What would I have called that last chapter? Maybe something like, Charlie Shows His Face. See what I mean? Corny. But if I had done it, if I had given these chapters a name, then this chapter would definitely have been called The Whole Truth. The night my wife died, I'd followed her in my car out to Southwell to Eric Atwell's place. It wasn't the first time I'd been there. After figuring out that Claire had gotten back into drugs and that she was most likely involved with someone at Black Barn Enterprises, I'd driven past the restored farmhouse a few times. I'd even seen Atwell once, at least I thought it was him. He was jogging along the sidewalk not far from his house, wearing a maroon jogging outfit. As he ran, he performed little boxing moves, punching like he was Rocky Balboa. On New Year's Eve that year, Claire and I had decided to stay home. She told me that there was a small party out at Black Barn, but now that she'd stopped taking drugs, at least that's what she'd told me, there was no reason for her to go. We roasted a chicken together that night. I made some mashed potatoes and she steamed some Brussels sprouts. We drank a bottle of Vermentino while we ate, then opened a second bottle after we'd cleaned up. We were settling in to watch a movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, one of Claire's favorites. I liked it too. At least I did back then. Now the very thought of it makes me nauseated. I must have fallen asleep because when I woke up, the film was over, the screen showing the menu options of the DVD. On the coffee table was a note from Claire. I'll be back soon. I promise, and I'm sorry. Love, C. I knew where she'd gone, of course. Outside, her Subaru was no longer parked on our street. I got into my Chevy Impala and drove out to Southwell. There was some kind of small party going on at Atwell's house when I got there. Five cars were in the driveway and two more along the street, including Claire's. I parked about 200 yards away, just pulling my car tight against the side of the road. This part of Southwell was sparsely populated. It was mostly gently rolling old farmland, crisscrossed by stone walls and dotted here and there by million-dollar homes. I left my car, stepping out into the cold, clear night. I'd departed my house so suddenly that I wasn't properly dressed, just wearing an old jean jacket over a sweater and jeans. I buttoned the jacket up to my throat, tucked my hands into my pockets, and walked along the road to Atwell's place. A small, discreet sign with the words Black Barn Enterprises was posted next to the mailbox. I stood there for a moment, studying the house from a distance. There was the farmhouse. Painted white and looming beside it was an enormous barn. I'd seen it in the daytime, of course, and it wasn't even painted black. It was more of a dark gray, but it had been modernized into a stylized workspace, its front doors replaced by solid glass, and the inside converted into an open concept work studio with modular desks and ping pong tables. Skirting along the edge of the property, I got close enough to the barn to see that even though it was lit by hanging industrial light fixtures, no one was inside. The party was happening inside the house. I went around the back of the barn to approach the house from the rear, and I was stunned for a moment by the view. It was close to a full moon, and there were no clouds in the sky. Atwell's property was on a slight ridge, and from where I stood, I could see across the sloping fields all the way to a line of dark trees, all bathed in silver moonlight. I stared at it for a few moments, shivering in my thin jacket, until suddenly I could hear laughter and could smell cigarette smoke in the air. At the rear corner of the barn, I could see the back deck, clearly an add-on to the farmhouse. A couple I didn't recognize smoked cigarettes and laughed uproariously, the specifics of their conversation getting carried away by the bitter wind. I watched them finish their cigarettes, then go back inside the house. After approaching the nearest window, I peered inside. There are many things I'll never forget about the night, but the image that I saw through the window is certainly one of them. About 20 people were milling about a large, well-furnished living room. At its center was an overstuffed leather couch, and that's where I could see Claire, dressed in a short green corduroy skirt and a cream silk blouse I felt as though I'd never seen before. She was next to Atwell, their shoulders touching, and she held a champagne glass in her hand. The room was dimly lit, but I could see that there was a small mound of white powder on the glass-topped coffee table, and one of the guests was kneeling on the carpeted floor, cutting himself a line. Techno music, the kind you'd hear in a club, pounded from the house, and behind the couch, three of the guests were dancing. But what I'll never really forget was how Claire looked. Not her clothes, and not even the way she was pressed up against Atwell, one of his hands touching her naked thigh, but the glow of her face. It was the drugs, but it was also something else, a gleam of pure animal joy. She kept laughing, her mouth open wide in a way that seemed unnatural, her lips wet. I walked back to my car, turned on the engine, and cranked the heat all the way up. I was shivering, but I was also crying. And then I got angry, punching my fist repeatedly against the roof of the car. I was angry at Claire, of course, and Atwell, but I think I was angry at myself most of all, at least right then. Because what I planned on doing was driving back to Somerville and waiting for my wife, hoping she'd return safe and sound and hoping one day she would return to just me. The car warmed up and I calmed down. From where I was parked, I could see Claire's Subaru along the road, and I decided to wait. I knew from past experience that she would not spend the night, that she'd be back before morning came, even though it might be late. And I knew that I would forgive her, that I would do what my mother always did with my father. I'd wait for her to return to me. But the longer I sat in my car, the engine purring, heat pumping from the vents, the more I found myself growing livid at Claire. I knew she was a drug addict, and that on some level she could not help herself. But she also looked so happy in Atwell's living room. So alive. It was 2:30 in the morning when I saw the two figures appear next to Claire's car. In the moonlight, I saw them come together and kiss. Then Claire opened the door. I could make out the hooded winter coat above the bare legs, and stepped inside while Atwell jogged back to his house. The brake lights came on, then she made a U-turn. Her headlights must have picked up my car in the shadow of a cluster of pine trees, but she must not have paid attention. She sped away down the street toward Route 2. I followed her. She drove fast on the back roads, but once she was on the highway heading back toward Boston, she slowed down to the exact speed limit. It was New Year's Eve, still, and police were probably out in force looking for drunk drivers. Something about that fact irked me, that despite whatever she'd ingested that night and whatever she'd done, she was careful enough to avoid getting pulled over. In the same way, I knew that when she got back to our shared apartment, she'd quietly sneak in the door, not wanting to wake me. And that when we talked about what happened the following morning, she'd cry and say she was a terrible person and beg forgiveness. She wanted the double life, but she didn't want the confrontation. It was the way she was. I remember thinking that I'd have more respect for her if she just left me, if she gave in to the fact that she'd rather be with Eric Atwell, that she'd rather be an addict. Then at least we could have it out. There were a few other cars along the two-lane highway, but not many. I stayed close behind her, not really worried that she'd notice. She hadn't noticed me on the side of the street outside of Atwell's house, and she probably wouldn't notice me now. I'd driven this route many times, and we were approaching an overpass. There was only a low guardrail along the edge. Suddenly, I imagined Claire losing control of her car, plunging off the edge and landing on the road below. Without thinking too much about it, I sped up, overtaking Claire in the passing lane. For a moment, we were side by side, and I looked over at her, but all I could see was her profile in darkness. She might have turned toward me, but it was hard to tell. What would she have seen? My face in darkness as well? Would she have recognized me? I overtook her, but stayed in my lane. The overpass was coming up fast, and I was imagining scenarios. What if I nudged her, edging my own car into her lane? Would she let us collide, spin out together, and go over the edge? Down deep, I knew that she wouldn't. My wife avoided collisions. That didn't stop her from wrecking her own life, but I knew that if I pulled into her lane, she'd swerve to avoid me. I did it. I cut diagonally across in front of her when we were barreling along the overpass, and she did exactly what I thought she'd do. She drove right off the edge. Back at home, I waited for the police to arrive. They showed up at 8 in the morning to tell me that my wife was dead. It was a relief, of course. I'd been worried that maybe I'd injured her in some horrible way. I'd also been worried that maybe she'd killed someone else when her car had landed on the road below. But she hadn't, and for that I was also grateful. It's a funny thing, grieving for someone you've murdered. In the beginning, my sadness was coupled with an enormous guilt. I kept wondering if I'd simply let Claire drive home that night, what would have happened next? Maybe she'd have asked me to check her into a rehabilitation center, said that she'd hit bottom and wanted to get better. Or maybe she'd have kept returning to Atwell for drugs, and I'd have let her do it, just waiting around, hoping she might change. Reading her diary helped. There was such a clear villain in the story of Claire and me, and that villain was Eric Atwell. Finding a way to kill him got me through the worst of my grief, and then time did its trick. I haven't gotten over it, but it did get easier. I bought the store and immersed myself in work. Even though I stopped reading crime novels myself, violent death loomed too large in them, I knew enough to help my customers. I was a bookseller, and I was good at it. That was enough. Chapter 31. The phone rang and then switched over to voicemail. I hit end on my cell phone and was about to destroy the phone when it buzzed. Gwen Mulvey was calling back.
"Hey."
"What's going on?"
she said.
"Have you heard anything?"
"Anything about what?"
"There's a dead man in Boston. His name is Marty Kingship, and he's Charlie. He's our Charlie. He killed Robin Callahan, Ethan Bird, and Jay Bradshaw. And he killed Bill Manso and Elaine Johnson. And one night ago, he killed Nicholas Pruitt in New Essex, Massachusetts."
"Slow down," she said. "Where is he now? You said he's dead?"
"I just called 911 and gave them the address. They should be on the way."
"Who killed him?"
"I did. I shot him late last night. More like this morning. He was going to kill Brian and Tess Murray and make it look like the murder from the Red House mystery."
"Who was he?"
"He'd been a police officer in Smithfield, Massachusetts. He'd retired and was living in Boston. He also killed Eric Atwell. He did it for me. I asked him to. That's how this whole thing started. It's my fault, really. I started it. Marty was insane, but I started it."
"You're going to need to slow down, Mal. Where are you right now? Can I come to you?"
For one brief moment, I thought about it. Thought about seeing Gwen again just one more time. But I also knew that there was no way to do that without ending up in a holding cell, and I had decided a long time ago that I would never willingly allow that to happen. I said, "Sorry, no.
and I can't talk long. As soon as we're done here, I'm getting rid of this cell phone. I have 5 minutes. What do you want to know?
I heard a sharp intake of breath.
Are you hurt?
She said.
No, I'm fine. Did you know it was him all along?
Marty? No, I didn't. We planned it all online and never gave each other our identities. He figured out who I was, then found my list and started using it. I only figured out who he was last night. If I'd known earlier, I would have told you.
You said Nicholas Pruitt is dead. That's the name you gave me, right? Last time we talked?
I thought that Pruitt might have been Charlie, but he wasn't. He died from an overdose of alcohol and some kind of drug. Check the house for Kingship's prints. They'll probably be there.
Good Lord.
Look, when you talk with the investigators on this case, just tell them that I called you with this information. You don't need to say that you came and found me in Boston. I want you to get your job back.
I'm not sure that'll happen.
I think it will. You'll get some credit for figuring out that the list and the murders were connected. Give them the information they don't have. He killed Eric Atwell with a gun he said he took from a crime scene. Tell them we met on a website called Duckburg. You'll be fine.
I have a lot more questions.
I have to go. Sorry, Gwen.
Can I ask you one more then?
Of course, I said. I knew what it would be.
What happened to my father? Did Marty kill Steve Clifton?
I must have hesitated for a few seconds because she added,
Or was it you? I need to know.
After my wife died, I have a very hard time remembering the following year. I had terrible dreams and I was filled with guilt and maybe I was drinking too much.
Okay,
she said. And during that time, I had this recurring dream and sometimes I wonder if it actually happened. It was cold where I was standing, but I could feel sweat beating up at the base of my neck while I talked. In this dream, I hit your father with my car. I got out to see if he was okay, and he wasn't, of course, but he was still alive. His legs were going one way and the top part of his body was going the other. I told him who I was and why I was there, and then I watched him die.
Okay, thanks,
Gwen said in a voice I couldn't read. It still feels like a dream, I said. It all feels like a dream.
Are you sure you can't meet with me? I could drive to you. I'd come alone.
No, I said after a moment. Sorry, Gwen. I just can't. I just don't think I could take it if I was arrested.
I told you I would come alone.
And I don't want to answer any more questions. I don't want to relive the past any more than I've had to do these past few days. It's been pure luck that I've had these few years, even though down deep I knew it couldn't last. Sorry, I can't see you again. It's impossible.
You do have a choice in the matter, Gwen said.
I don't. I really don't. It might not seem like it to you, but the last 5 years, I have terrible dreams every night. I managed to keep going because it was all I knew how to do, but there hasn't been any joy in it. I'm not afraid anymore, but I am tired. I thought I heard a sigh on the other end of the line.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
Gwen said. No.
Okay. But what you've told me is the truth?
Yes, I said. Everything I've said is true. Chapter 32. Claire Mallory, Eric Atwell, Norman Chaney, Stephen Clifton, Robin Callahan, Ethan Bird, Jay Bradshaw, Bill Manso, Elaine Johnson, Nicholas Pruitt, Marty Kingship. Those are the names of the dead. The real names. All except for Marty Kingship. I don't know why I changed his name for the purposes of this narrative. Maybe because he has children, and they, like all children, are innocent of their parents' crimes. And maybe it's because he's the only one who deserves blame for what happened. Besides me, of course. It's funny, I just now realize that Marty Kingship has my initials. Freudian slip, I suppose. I also suppose that astute readers out there will be convinced that there is no Marty Kingship, that there is only Malcolm Kershaw, and that I did all the killings myself. It's not true. I wish it was, in a way. It would make for a clever ending. What is true is that I am responsible for everything that happened. Marty carried most of the acts out, but I was the architect. It all started with me. That is the truth. I have committed the sin of omission, but when I said something is true, it is. Believe me. I am in Rockland, Maine. After shooting Marty Kingship, he looked almost pleased as he touched the blood coming through his sweater, then shuddered and died. I went first to Brian Murray. He'd woken when I'd fired the shot, of course, lifting his head and muttering something. I sat by his side and told him that it was a champagne bottle he'd heard. He rolled over and began to snore again. Then I checked on Tess. Humphrey was no longer occupying the sofa across from her. He'd heard the shot and disappeared. As Marty had said, some guard dog. Tess was still breathing and she was on her side, so if she did vomit, I thought she'd be okay. It meant that I didn't need to call 911 right away. I would call them soon enough, but I wanted just a little bit of time. I returned to my own apartment and packed a bag. Cold weather clothes, some toiletries, my favorite picture of Claire. It was from our honeymoon, 2 rainy weeks in London, the best weeks of my life. The picture was taken in a pub, Claire sitting across from me, a slight smirk on her face, not sure she really wanted to have her picture taken, but happy nonetheless. I thought about going to Old Devil's one last time, saying goodbye to Nero, but it would take time that I wasn't sure I had. I needed to call the police and let them know that there was a dead body in the residence of Brian and Tess Murray. I wanted to do this soon, of course, because of Tess and the drugs in her system, but I also didn't want Brian to wake up early in the morning to find a corpse in his bedroom. The sky was beginning to lighten as I drove into New Hampshire. I pulled off the highway next to a 24-hour convenience store, and using cash, I bought enough canned food and bottled beer to last me a week. After loading up the trunk of my car in the parking lot, I called 911 on my cell phone, identified myself, and said there was a dead man at 59 Deering Street in Boston. Then I called Gwen, and when she called me back, we had the conversation that I've already written about. Afterward, I smashed the cell phone with a brick I found in the parking lot, then put the pieces in a trash bin outside of the store. If they decided to trace me, then I guess they'd figure out that I was traveling north. But I wasn't too worried about it. It had actually snowed a lot less north of the city. There was a scrim of white over everything, more frost than snow, and in the dawn hours the sky was a checkerboard of thin clouds. The world was colorless. I reached Rockland by mid-morning. I considered waiting somewhere until it was dark again, but decided to risk it instead. There was only one other house with a view of Elaine Johnson's old property, and I would just have to hope that whoever lived there was not spending the morning looking out the window. From my previous visit to Elaine's house, I'd noticed the single-car garage. Its door had been up, and I remembered it as being empty inside. Elaine's car, a rusty Lincoln, probably too big for the garage, had sat encased in ice in the driveway. I found the house immediately, not far from Route 1, and turned into the unplowed drive with enough speed so that I didn't get stuck. I pulled around the Lincoln and into the garage, killed the engine, then got out and yanked down the garage door by its rusted handle. I had briefly looked across the street before I did this, toward a boxy, shingled house, smoke billowing from its chimney. I was happy that the front of the garage wasn't angled toward the street. Hopefully no one would notice that its door was now down. I popped a single pane of glass from the back door, reached in and unlocked it. Once I was inside with my food and my duffel bag, I found some cardboard and tape and sealed the door back up. The heat was still on, although the thermostat was set to the low 60s. It was cold, but bearable. I unpacked my food and put the beer in the fridge next to what remained of Elaine's unclaimed provisions. It was clear that she had been living on cottage cheese and tinned fruit. There was a decent couch in the living room, mid-century style with wooden legs and a low back. I decided that I would sleep there. I went upstairs to look for clean sheets and a blanket and found them in the master bedroom closet. All I could think about was Marty in his clown mask emerging from this very closet to scare Elaine Johnson to death. She wasn't my favorite person, but she hadn't deserved that. When I got back to the living room, I knew that I would never go upstairs again. It's been 4 days and I'm still here. I work on this manuscript and I eat canned beef stew and tomato soup. The beer is gone, but I found several gallon bottles of Gallo Burgundy in the cellar and I'm working steadily through those. Mostly what I do is read. During the day, I sit in a comfortable club chair by a window. At night, I read on the couch, using a penlight under a blanket to see. I'm reading mysteries again, not just because they are the only books here, but because I don't have much time left and I want to revisit some of my favorites. I find that I am most drawn to books I first read when I was barely a teenager. Agatha Christie novels, Robert Parker's, Gregory MacDonald's Fletch novels. I read When the Sacred Gin Mill Closes by Lawrence Block in one sitting and cried after finishing the last sentence. I do wish there were more poetry books in this house. I found an anthology of American poetry that had been published in 1962, but I also managed to write down some of my favorite poems from memory. Winter Nightfall, of course, by Sir John Squire, Obad by Philip Larkin, Crossing the Water by Sylvia Plath, and at least half the stanzas from Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard by Thomas Gray. There is no internet here, and I don't have a phone. I am sure they are looking for me, the man who killed Marty Kingship, the man who has the answers to a string of related murders. I don't know how much Gwen has helped them out. I assume that she has told them everything about our phone call. Maybe she hasn't told them how we met in Boston after she'd been suspended. I wonder if she might figure out where I am. So far, no one has come knocking on this door. They'll still have plenty of questions. Gwen, I'm sure, still has questions. That's one of the reasons why I'm writing this memoir. I want to set the record straight. I want to tell the whole truth. I wrote that I burned Claire's entire diary after reading it. That's not entirely true. I saved one page, probably because I wanted some proof that she had loved me, something in her own handwriting. The entry was from the spring of 2009, and this is what she wrote. I don't write enough about Mal in these pages and how happy he can make me. I come home late and he's always on the couch, waiting. More often than not, he is asleep, a book cracked open and across his chest. Last night when I woke him up, he was so pleased to see me. He said he'd read a poem that he thought I'd like. I did like it, maybe even loved it. It's a Bill Knott, and I'm going to copy it down here so I will never forget. It's called Goodbye. If you are still alive when you read this, close your eyes. I am under their lids, growing black. What else have I lied about? I don't know if this was a lie so much as an omission, but when I killed Norman Cheney up in Tickhill, New Hampshire, I made it sound as though after I strangled him, I left him there on the floor. But in reality, after checking his pulse, I must have panicked, because I picked up the crowbar and hit him in the face and head repeatedly. I won't describe what he looked like when I'd finished, but I sat down on the floor and thought that I would never get up again, that I would never be sane again. It was Nero coming across the floor that eventually saved me. He gave me a reason to get up and out of the house. I think I made it sound as though I'd saved Nero, but he was actually the one who saved me. Trite, I know. But the truth sometimes is. When I told Gwen about my dream of killing Stephen Clifton, I was telling the truth as well. The truth as I know it. I really don't remember a lot of what happened in that year after Claire's death, after I ran Claire off the road, I guess I should say. But I do remember that dream, that vivid dream of hitting Clifton with my car. And there are moments, lucid moments, when I remember everything, when it all falls into place. But those moments never last. Stephen Clifton was terrified. I remember his face. It was pale as milk, almost a blur. It was Gwen's face. I suppose it wasn't a dream after all. There's one other omission I ought to record. When Marty and I were talking in the Murray's house, the night he told me everything, I asked him about the comment he left on the old devil's website, the comment he posted using the name Dr. Shepherd. He'd looked confused when I asked him about it. Dr. Shepherd, I said. He was the killer in the murder of Roger Ackroyd. Now that I think about it, I think that it is possible I was the one who left that comment. It rings a distant bell. Like I've said, there have been many nights in the past few years when I don't know what is real and what is a dream. Claire, her face in darkness, turning and looking at me from her car right before I nudged her off the overpass. Norman Chaney, what was left of him, on the floor of his house in Tickhill. The jolt of the car as Stephen Clifton went flying through the summery air. Beer sometimes helps. And maybe I drank so much that I left myself a message in the comment section for 8 perfect murders. And if it was me, then it was a premonition of sorts. I am reading The Murder of Roger Ackroyd now, again. I found a copy at the bottom of a stack in the corner of Elaine Johnson's dining room. It's the pocket paperback edition. Ackroyd slumped over in his chair on the cover, a knife protruding from high up on his back. It's a dull book, really, until you get to the last 2 chapters. I've already mentioned the penultimate one, the chapter titled The Whole Truth. Well, the last chapter is called Apologia, and it is the chapter that makes you realize that all along, you've been reading a suicide note. It is snowing outside, and the wind is battering at the windows of the house. I have taken a huge risk and lit a fire in the fireplace. Still, I don't think anyone will notice a little bit of chimney smoke during a storm like this one. It's so nice by the fire with a glass of wine. For my last book, I am reading And Then There Were None. If it isn't my favorite novel of all time, it's pretty damn close. Appropriate, too, for the circumstances. I'd like to say something here about how I'll be with Claire again soon, but I don't believe any of that nonsense. When we die, we become nothing. The same nothing we were before we were born, but of course this time that nothingness is forever. But if it's where Claire is, in the black, in the nothing, then that is where I should be as well. My plan is that when the storm comes to an end and the plows have done their job, I will fill the pockets of my winter coat with the heavy glass paperweights from the shelf in the living room. At nightfall, I will walk from the house into Rocklands Center, and from there out to the jetty, the one that extends a mile out to the sea, creating a breakwater for Rockland Harbor. I will walk to the end and just keep going. I'm not looking forward to the cold water, but I don't suppose I'll feel the cold for very long. There will be some satisfaction that I'll die by drowning. That in a sense I'll be fulfilling one of the murders from my list, McDonald's the Drowner. Maybe they'll wonder if it wasn't a suicide after all, or maybe my body will never be found. It's nice to think I'll leave a mystery in my wake. This is Graham Halstead. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of 8 Perfect Murders, a novel by Peter Swanson. Presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Copyright 2020 by Peter Swanson. Production copyright 2020 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.